Hi, this is the Reader's Group with Debbie and Pam, and this is Debbie. I don't have Pam with me this morning. I have someone a lot more special. I have author Lee Child. Hi, Lee.
Hi, Debbie. How are you?
I'm doing just fine. And Pam won't have any problem with me saying that. She's extremely jealous that I'm here this morning, minus her.
Yeah, well, I remember Pam, so I'll say, hi, Pam. Sorry that you're not here.
Oh, Pam's wonderful. And I'm going to get to see her tomorrow morning.
Okay.
So I'll be able to tell her all about everything that happened this weekend. And I've had this horrible job of driving you around. It's a bad job, and somebody's got to do it.
Yeah.
And I have so many people that are very, very jealous of me that I like that.
I can't imagine why. It's been grueling, hasn't it?
It was. It was a long day yesterday. But you were up for 18 hours?
Something like that, yeah. But, you know, writer's life is a tough one. You got to do it.
And thank goodness you don't. I mean, I know the last time you were on tour, you were touring for about 30 days straight,
mm-hmm.
which about killed you.
Mm-hmm.
but this one was just a short jaunt out here to Phoenix.
Yeah, it's been very broken up this year. I started actually way, way back at the end of March was when I started mm-hmm. touring, but it's all been broken up into kind of bite-sized pieces. I've been home in between. But then, of course, when I've been home, I've been trying to finish next year's book. So
mm-hmm.
it's not been a restful 3 months, really. But it's been fun.
Okay. And we need to say your new book, which is the sixth book in the Jack Reacher series that we're talking about this morning, although we'll talk about a bunch of other things,
mm-hmm.
Is called Without Fail.
Yeah, and it's out in all over the world. It's out right now, I guess, yeah.
In paperback, or in hardcover.
Yeah, hardcover.
And I was asking, we were at the Poisoned Pen last night, and I was asking what edition, there's the American edition hardcover
mm-hmm.
and the European edition, which was selling more. And they actually said the European edition, and I'm going to go ahead and say this, but I really prefer the American cover.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting question, that, because where we were last night is a specialist bookstore that is, I mean, obviously they have a lot of regular readers there, but
right.
they also have a lot of collectors. And the collectors want what they call the true first, which is the
right.
first appearance
mm-hmm.
in the English language in the world, which happens to be the UK edition this year. So they were snapping those up like crazy, which is fine. But, you know, the difference is that in the UK, hardcover books are difficult to sell, because the concept of selling an expensive book is difficult anywhere,
mm-hmm.
frankly. But in the UK, it's especially hard. So what they do is they plan to make it cheap, frankly. They say, okay, whereas traditionally a hardcover book would be £18, which would be, you know, like $25. They aim way lower than that, and they say, we're going to sell these books now at £10 or £12. And so they make them cheaper to start with. And the paper is not as nice, and the binding is not as nice. The jacket art is their attempt at the best they can do, and within the limits of cost. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, for them, it's pretty good. It works for their market. What's interesting is that jackets work differently in different markets. And if you prefer the American jacket, then
mm-hmm.
that kind of makes sense, because here you are in Arizona.
That's true.
So the mm-hmm. graphics guys in New York are taking you into account rather than anybody else.
Uh-huh.
And so it's that proves to me it's working right.
Mm-hmm. In the European market, does the book come out sooner than we got it in the U.S.?
Yeah, it does. I mean, in terms of English language, which is what we're really talking about, because the foreign language translations,
mm-hmm.
They can be more or less simultaneous, or they can be like up to a year late. So if you look at just the English language, yeah, the UK edition came out, let me see, it was April 2nd, whereas the US one came out May 15th. So
okay.
that's a pretty big gap there.
Mm-hmm.
So the UK had, what, 7 weeks or something like that,
mm-hmm.
jump on the US.
Now, do they pretty much do the same thing with holding them in hardcover for a year and then releasing them in paper?
Yeah, they do exactly a year. So I do a book
mm-hmm.
a year. And so in both countries, what happens is every year, more or less on the same date, the new hardcover comes out. And on that same date, the old hardcover goes into paperback. So
okay.
it's kind of endless conveyor belt, a new hardback, a new paperback every year.
And, you know, I myself love hardcovers, and I've never understood how people who are avid readers and have these huge fans, or, you know, have these huge authors that they just love, and they're willing to wait for the paper. I'd rather die.
Well, I'm very happy that there are people like you, Debbie. I really but, yeah, I mean, the waiting thing is, you know, it is perverse, because if you're really, really into something, it's almost a clue as to how into it are you.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I get a lot of letters from people who say that they always wait for the paperback, except they can't bear to with mine, so they get the hardcover.
But oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah, it is. It's a compliment, you know, and it's a thrill. But to me, they're almost different products. You know, a hardcover is a book, and a paperback is something different. You know, obviously the book is in there, it's word for word identical, but
mm-hmm.
it's you have to look at it as more of a delivery system. You know, it's like a cheap thing, it's $7 or $8, and mm-hmm. it's something that you can take to the beach or you can read in the bath. It's a totally different kind of delivery system that I think actually for the mass market of general readers will actually kill the idea of ebooks, because it is pretty difficult to conceive of a better, cheaper way of delivering a story than a paperback book.
Okay. You know, I'm an avid ebook fan.
I know you are. And you see,
it's that gadget thing.
It is. You know, you've got to look at who you are.
Mm-hmm.
You're an avid reader, you're very technologically adept, and you're a gadget freak. And a lot of people aren't all of those things. And it seems to me that with an ebook, you know that you're a reader, you know you are, you always have been, and so you're prepared to invest the upfront cost of the reader thing, you know, whatever the electronic
right.
gizmo is.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's $100 or $200, you're prepared to invest that and then fill it up with ebooks as you go along. But a lot of people, because don't forget, well, hopefully when you're selling well, you're talking about millions of paperback
right.
sales. Most of those people are kind of impulse readers. They're not prepared to say to themselves, even subconsciously, I'm a reader, therefore I'm going to invest up front and commit up front to this electronic reader thing. They just wouldn't do that. What they do is they think, they don't really consider themselves readers, except when they're going on vacation, they pass through the airport and they buy a paperback.
Impulse buys.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Impulse buys, and they would never self-describe themselves as readers. You know, mm-hmm. you have a great license plate on your car, which makes it, you know, that's
my book bug.
Right. And you identify yourself. If somebody said to you, who are you? You know, you would say a number of things. Probably you would say, you know, you're a person, you're a mom, you're a reader. You would include reader in there pretty high on the list.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people wouldn't do that, even though they are readers. You know, it's not something they're kind of prepared to describe themselves as. So for them, paperback books are absolutely brilliant. There's no guilt with a paperback. You know, you take a hardcover to the beach, you feel guilty, right? Because you've got all this background from school, from home, from libraries, that you must not damage a book, you mustn't ruin a book. And so you would never take your hardcover to the beach, but you take a paperback to the beach, and, you know, if a page falls out or if you get suntan lotion all
mm-hmm.
over, you don't really care.
Well, you know, I almost drove back from Mexico minus my husband because I was searching for someone at our beach house to help with something, and my hardback was down on the shore with my towel, and the tide came in. And my husband was down there. And he didn't rescue the book, didn't care about the towel,
yeah.
didn't care, he didn't rescue the hardcover book.
Well, that's every woman's ambition, leave your husband in Mexico.
Yeah, isn't that the truth? And I want to just mention a little bit about, I told you before that I think without fail, I say that because I'd really have to go back and reread all of the previous 5 books. I Think Without Fail is my favorite.
Well, I'm delighted about that.
But I tend, the book I'm reading by an author, when it's very good, I tend to think, oh, this is my favorite. <You know? laughs> But I am pretty sure without fail, and I told you before, The Killing Floor had probably always stayed there. Now, this book is about a woman in the Secret Service
mm-hmm.
who contacts Jack Reacher, who is your main character throughout all your books, and to help her figure out ways that the vice president could be assassinated.
Yeah, it's called a security audit, which
mm-hmm.
means, and I think a lot of places actually run these things.
Mm-hmm.
I know that a lot of industries run it, for instance, from the point of view of their network security, where they have a security force or a team, and they do the very best they can, but what they need to do is get outside the box and test it with some
mm-hmm.
random outside challenge. So the story is that this woman in the Secret Service figures out, she's confident she's doing the best she can because she's a smart professional operator, But she needs to know, for the sake of perfectionism, is she doing the very best she can? And she figures the way to do that would be to hire some kind of radical off-the-wall tough guy to test the security, to see what has she missed, what has she not thought about. So she needs to find such a guy. And she, years and years ago, went out with a person who sometimes used to talk about his brother. And the person, it was Joe Reacher, it's Jack Reacher's brother, who's no longer alive. And she remembers him mentioning his little brother Jack, and she figures, yeah, that's the sort of guy that I need for this test. So she, with all the government databases that she's got access to, she tracks him down and asks him the question, will you assassinate the vice president? And, you know, that's the dramatic end, really, of chapter one. It's a hell of a question.
And that grabs, as I read the first chapter, and I was telling people, oh my gosh, you got to read this new book. This is the concept, you know. And that just, I think, has grabbed everyone, you know, really quickly.
It seems to have. And I worked really hard on chapter one, you know, because in this business, you can think that you're doing well, and you can think that you're pretty far into your career, but still it's all about some person going into a bookstore with no idea who you are. They pick up the book, and typically they'll look at the jacket, they'll look at the back, then they'll open it and look at page one. And so the first line, the first paragraph, the first page, the first chapter, that is all you've got, you know. That's make or break. And so I work very hard on chapter one to make sure that it nails people down kind of halfway through the first line and then never lets them go.
And you did it. Thank you, by the way. There's been a major change in your career, and I wanted to talk a little bit about how that might have affected you. You have changed publishing houses for the first time, and you have gone to Random House, which I was pleased because I do a lot of work with Random House, and they have been wonderful to me and really open doors. So I'm thrilled over that. But was this a hard decision for you to make?
It was very, very hard because I started with Penguin Putnam, who have been fine and great to me, and there are some great people there that I like very much. But you've got to kind of sometimes step back from your personal feelings and think about it as a career. And it's difficult to talk about ambition, but if you're in a thing, it seems to me, if you're in it, you may as well win it. And, you know, there's no point in doing something and settling for fourth place. So I looked at it and I figured maybe another publisher with a sort of renewed initial burst of enthusiasm could just bump it up another notch into something bigger. So this time around, for the first time, we talked to other publishers, and Random House came forward and said, yeah, we really want you, and we really think that we could do really well with you, and this is what we plan to do, and this is how we plan to do it. And it was a very captivating plan, and you know, what they're promising is much wider exposure and more readers. So we went with them.
Now, it just occurred to me, I was giving you some names yesterday of publicists with Random House, and you weren't sure who your publicist was. And I deal a lot with the West Coast publishers and publicists. Will that be the case with your book, or will it be strictly a publicist out of New York?
I think it'll be directed from New York, yeah.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure that'll happen.
All right. And I do know a couple people from New York, but the majority of the people are on the West Coast.
Right.
Now, I'm going to actually, you know what, let's take a break, okay. And I'm going to come back with a figure here. And we'll be back with the Readers Group with Debbie and Pam.
Thank you.
We're back with the Readers Group with Debbie and Pam. My special guest today is author Lee Child, and we're discussing his book, Without Fail. And we're going to jump a little away from that because, and you know, this is probably like being an athlete, possibly being a movie star, when the media is aware of how much your new contract is.
Uh-huh.
And what I was told was your new contract with Random House was a $6 million contract.
Uh-huh.
Is that correct?
Well, I'm not, you know, because of the politics of the industry and other authors worrying about, you know, if Random House is paying me that, why aren't they paying him that?
Mm-hmm.
I'm actually not allowed to say, but I'm not going to, you notice that I'm not either shaking my head or nodding.
Okay,
I'm not
right.
going white, I'm
right.
not going red, so.
And that's okay. And everybody knows, Lee. It's supposed to be a closely guarded secret, I guess, but it's a secret that everyone knows. And when I was telling someone, they corrected me with the figure. And, you know, everyone knows. If Random House thinks they'd keep this quiet, they don't have a clue.
So you were telling somebody what, that it was less or that it was
no,
more?
No, actually, I got you and Harlan Coban's contract mixed up.
Right, I think.
And I stated yours as Harlan's.
I heard like 8 or 9 for him.
8.
Yeah.
And I stated yours at 8.
And his at 6.
The person I was talking to said, no, Lee's getting the 6, Harlan Coban's getting the 8.
Yeah.
And I said, oh, I'm sorry. You know, I mean, we're talking millions here. But.
Yeah, I mean, all I'm officially, put it this way, I'm officially allowed to say that it's in 7 figures.
Okay.
And when we'll then conclude the UK deal for the appropriate number of more books to bring them into line.
Mm-hmm.
And that is also a segment of Random House.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we're planning to do then, when we've done that deal, we'll kind of amalgamate the two deals for the press release, whereupon it will probably be an 8-figure deal.
Okay.
So, yeah, we are. It's a very, very long way from when I started out, when I got $60 a week unemployment when I started writing.
And you also, and I kind of warned you yesterday when you told me this story, mm-hmm. and I have to get you to tell the story about the dog chewing up the book. Just because this turns you into a human being. And I don't mean to take you off that pedestal.
I don't
want
to be
on the
pedestal.
But it's so nice to
yeah.
see the human being side of you.
Well, it was a long time ago, and we had a dog, a Springer Spaniel called Stanley, who was the world's greatest dog, in my opinion. Just fabulous dog. And he was a maniac. He was a puppy until he was about 12 years old. And then he was normal for a couple of years, and then he was geriatric for about another 4 years. But during his puppy phase, which, as I say, lasted more than a decade, he would chew stuff. And I know that, you know, you're a big dog person and love dogs,
yes.
and you must have got a whole bunch of chewed up stuff, just
right.
like I have. But Stanley only ever chewed one book in his whole life, and we have thousands of books in the house. He only ever chewed one. And the spooky thing about that was that the particular book he chewed was Roots by Alex Haley. You know, big, thick
right.
saga, fabulous book. That's the only one he ever chewed. And coincidentally, that's the only book I ever stole. My wife really, really wanted it. We were too poor. There was no way I could go out and buy it. So I went out and stole it, shoplifted it for her. And out of all the books in the house, the dog chewed that one up. And I'm thinking, what does that mean?
Like I said, and I think my reply back was that I have never shoplifted a book.
No.
And we just ended at that.
Oh, yeah.
And but like I said, that just made you so human because...
I just hope there's not too many cops from that particular town in England that is listening to the show.
Now, see, you could have said Phoenix, Arizona, and I have cops relatives out here could have arrested you. Have you ever gone back to that store?
Actually, the store is not there anymore. It was
okay.
part of a chain that got bought out, and I suppose, you know, the assets belong to somebody now. But the store is... We actually went there just... at Christmas time, because we were in England visiting my brother and his family.
Mm-hmm.
And because, you know, we love books, and you know what book people are like, we wanted to buy his kids some books that our daughter had loved very much. So we went in search of this bookstore, and it was not there anymore. I think it was some kind of a, I think it was a toy store or something. But the bookstore was gone, so I feel relatively safe now that maybe they won't catch
now,
me.
Now, see, Lee, I just, you know, I had these pictures yesterday of somebody unknown coming in, shoplifting a book from my store, and then coming back 15, 20 years later,
and
being famous and paying for it, and me being able to put a sign up that a book was shoplifted here by Lee Child.
Well, I'm perfectly happy to come to your store and pay.
Okay. You had a very successful signing last night at the Poison Pen Bookstore.
It was great, wasn't it?
Yeah. It was standing room only.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very impressed. I mean, not that I don't know that there aren't plenty of people that read your books, but people take time out of their lives to come down and to hear you speak and enraptured with you. What is that a setting you like as far as discussions? What's your favorite setting as far as a signing and discussion?
Pretty much how it was last night. Mm-hmm. You know, a really nice bookstore full of people, and the interesting thing about it, say this year, maybe a little bit last year, is that you notice people come in this in large numbers, which is mm-hmm. great, obviously, but they come with a certain energy and a certain attitude, which I think we are now 6 years down the road.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, I'm beginning to see that Reacher as a character in the series is not mine anymore. It's kind of passing into shared ownership. It's almost in public ownership. You notice that many of those people last night were, you know, Reacher belongs to them now as much as he belongs
to
me. Oh,
yes, he does.
Yeah, it's a kind of, and they come not so much to kind of listen to me, but they come to share with me and with each other their enthusiasm about Reacher. And I love that, you know, because mm-hmm. it is a crucial stage where a character who is, after all, doesn't exist really, you know, he's invented, he's fictional, but a character becomes first of all real, and then he kind of moves out into public ownership and becomes a shared icon rather than just a passive thing to consume, you know. So that's what I got out of yesterday, was that a lot of people came, but, you know, last year a lot of people came also, but they mm-hmm. came this year with kind of different energy, you know, and a different attitude. It was more or less like a convention. It was people coming together because they loved the character. It was not so much a talker and an audience, you know. It was a convention. It was great.
Now, something I have found with the several days in the course of our two travels, that you're very modest. And we were at a place yesterday, and there was a beautiful woman there who was going gaga over you. I don't know how else to say it. And we walked out. Now, she's married. I happen to have met her husband before, and I asked you if I'd like to see the effect you have on unmarried women, seeing the effect you have on married women. And you stated, it's not me, it's Jack Reacher. I didn't go into it yesterday because I knew right then it would be a question here today. I disagree. I completely 100% disagree. But this is a question, believe it or not. Do you get that effect on men? Because I saw that last night with men also.
Yeah, well, which makes me think it has to be Jack Reacher, you know, because you know, clearly people love Reacher, and of course, he, you know, I'm not a dumb person, therefore I wrote him in a way to make him appealing, mm-hmm. and he is appealing, and people really react to him very well. And then the effect that they show towards me, I think, is kind of two things. It's partly the natural instinct that readers have to assume that the character is somehow based on the writer, which I think it is in a way. You know, you're bound to, if you're writing about a character, mm-hmm. that he is bound to share some of your own characteristics. So maybe in a little way they're right, that they're assuming that Reacher and I are, if not exactly the same person, then we're kind of similar. And the other thing, I think, is they're almost kind of saying thank you, you know, because you've written this book that we've really enjoyed. So their personal affection is really a way of saying, you know, thanks for writing the book. I think those two things together kind of explain the energy, because like you say, it comes from men too.
Mm-hmm.
And we're assuming that, you know, most of these men are straight, and then most of them are married, and they're just enthusiastic about the product. Rather than, it can't be some kind of personal enthusiasm for me, one assumes.
Because there were just as many men as there were women there last night. And I always think, and the thing is, I hate to say this, I am probably more partial to men authors, and there are a lot of wonderful women authors that I love, but I am probably more partial to men. I probably read more men. And I do think of you as a man's author. Jack Reacher is a man's man,
mm-hmm.
but I think that's the appealing thing about you, is that you're also a man's man. Do you get told that?
I'm old enough now that I've been through all these phases. You know, I've been through feminism, I've been through post-feminism, I've been through new man, I've been through post-modern man, and I'm just who I am, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the thing about me, and I think therefore the thing about Reacher, is that I really genuinely like women. You know, I have no issue with women at all. There's nothing I don't like about women. I love women. And it's way beyond the need to kind of prove that I'm a feminist or prove that I believe in equality or anything like that. Just way beyond it. You know, I just love women and being around them. And I think Reacher shows the same thing. Reacher does not discriminate in any way. He won't mm-hmm. go out of his way more for a woman or less. He will treat a woman as a complete equal. And I think women readers respond to that mm-hmm. really well. And it's one of the things that has made me happiest of all, is that Reacher, who is this rough, tough guy, you know, with dubious hygiene, and he lives this appalling lifestyle. He's practically a barbarian, if you analyze him.
Uh-huh.
Women have gone for him in a big way. And that is terrific, because it shows somehow that I'm neither writing for men or women. I'm just writing a book. And whoever reads it is liable to respond absolutely equally.
I loved what you said last night about the book you wrote where you forgot to mention him bathing or changing clothes.
Yeah.
And the women that responded to that, because they love Reacher, but you got to bathe them for us.
That is so funny, because it was the fourth book, Running Blind, and I was so concerned really to keep the pace moving fast, you know, blasting mm-hmm. through the book from page one to the end, that I didn't do the scene where he throws away his clothes and buys fresh clothes. I just forgot altogether. So technically he's in the same clothes throughout the whole book. And yeah, people were very upset. And that kind of shows me a whole bunch of things. First of all, how literally people take, you know, they get into it so vividly. They're living alongside the character to the point where they can smell the character. Secondly,
which wasn't a good thing in that book.
It was not. It was probably a dangerous thing. Secondly, that they care about him in a way that is almost nurturing, you know? Mm-hmm. I would say the woman audience for Reacher splits kind of into two halves, I think, and I think it depends a lot on age of the reader, frankly. The ones that kind of want to hang out with Reacher, and the ones who want to take care of him or mother him. And the mothering ones were, like, really worried about the fact that he was not showering through that book.
And see, And I am a clean freak. I mean, I take 2 to 3 showers a day,
wow.
especially here in the summer. I'm just a nut about it. And I never noticed the shower thing reading the book. So, but I would love to hang out with Reacher. So, and everybody listening, in our own way, I have been able to do that.
Well, it's a kind of, it is a man-woman thing, I think. It's also a military thing, because don't forget, Reacher is ex-military.
Yeah.
And part of Reacher's whole story, for me anyway, is the clash between military culture and civilian culture. He was born and raised in the military, served in the military, and now suddenly he's in the civilian world. And the differences are very hard for him to cope with. And one of those differences, I know for sure, is approach to a thing like hygiene. Especially, I mean, I guess if you're on post somewhere in the U.S. and life is pretty normal, then yeah, you're just like a normal person who showers and changes every day or 3 times a day like you. But when you're not on post, if you're serving somewhere, I mean, my dad was in the British Army at the end of World War II, and I told him this story, you know, about running blind and Reacher's clothes, and he said, well, I served from D-Day to VE Day in one pair of pants. And, you know, that is the reality for these military guys.
Yes, yes.
Especially during times of tension or war. Mm-hmm. I mean, literally for, what was that? That was 11 months. He, all the way across mm-hmm. Europe, he beat Hitler wearing one pair of trousers. And that was the reality. And I think the interesting thing for me is I learned from my dad that you very, very quickly accept things in the military as being totally normal that are freakish outside of the military.
Mm-hmm.
So with Reacher, I'm trying to examine that tension, that he is living in the civilian world, but he is living a military-style life. And so that I am a little amazed, and he's certainly amazed, that anybody would find anything wrong with it.
And, you know, people in times of war, there's so many things that the normal person doesn't understand, especially here in the United States. Having, and especially our women population in the United States. And just from people I've talked to from World War II and, you know, and others, I think that you have, you've managed to pick up the military, I guess, when I see Reacher. And does most of that come from your father?
I guess it does, you know, but we've hardly ever talked about it. It's one of these things where there are little tiny clues that you can build into larger mm-hmm. impressions. You know, he was not a hero, my dad. He was not anything special. He was just one of millions of guys. He didn't win any medals. He just, you know, served his time. But what fascinated him was, as I say, the totally different world that it was, you know, the mm-hmm. different rules and the different laws and the different ways of doing things. And I guess that did make a big impression on me, because it certainly did on him. You know, he worked in a regular job the whole rest of his life, after only spending this couple of years in the army, and yet it had a disproportionate influence on him, or a disproportionate effect. You mm-hmm. know, it never left him, really, the intensity of those experiences. And so I guess I picked up on that to some extent. But it does work, and I am incredibly flattered, because I get a lot of letters from people in the military,
mm-hmm.
even people that are actually in the military police, and they say, yeah, this is great, you're telling it just like it is, and you're doing a great job, and I'm very, very flattered about that.
I want to take another break, and then I want to come back and ask you about your research, and then I still have a few more questions,
okay.
too. We'll be back with the Readers Group with Debbie and Pam and our guest, Lee Child. We're back with the Readers Group with Debbie and Pam and my wonderful conversation with author Lee Child. And I always want to give the name of the book again. It's called Without Fail. And Without Fail, you need to go out and buy it.
Yeah, sure.
It will be one of the best books of the year on your reading list. I guarantee it, because it is on mine. Something else, and you know, I should have brought this up in the break and asked if I could mention it, so I'm going to do it without a name, and then if you shake your head no, I'm going to jump into something else, and I'll cut the tape. last time you were in Phoenix, a year ago,
uh-huh.
When you returned home, you had a message on your answering machine.
I did.
Can we talk about that?
Yeah, we can talk about that, because okay. I was very happy to have it there, yeah.
Okay, and, well, I'm impressed to even sit near you. But Bill Clinton left a message on your answering machine tape.
He did, yeah. And Bill is, as well as being, he was an 8-year president, he was also a tremendous reader in this genre.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and it's not just me. Michael Connelly,
mm-hmm.
The same. A couple of other writers as well, I'm sure. That Walter Mosley, of course.
Mm-hmm.
I think Bill Clinton more or less boosted his career,
wow.
maybe even created his career
mm-hmm.
by reading him publicly. Clinton is a tremendous reader in this genre. He loves crime fiction and adventure. And I don't know how, but he got hold of my books early on, I guess. And the first I ever heard from him was, I think, about maybe a year and a half ago. I was going to do an event at a library in New York State, which was actually Chappaqua Library, which is where the Clintons live.
Mm-hmm.
And so the library people sent out invitations to, you know, their townspeople saying, come to hear this panel of writers. It was really organized by a local writer from Chappaqua called Suzanne Chazin, who writes a tremendous series about New York Fire Department, you know, the firefighters in New York. She organized it and asked me to be on the panel. And so they sent out these invites, and we got a handwritten reply from Bill Clinton saying that he couldn't come because he was in India, but he was really sorry he couldn't come because he loves Jack Reacher. And so, you know, I was very flattered about that. So obviously when the next book was due out, I sent him a copy. I actually drove it around to his house and gave it to the Secret Service guy on the gate. And he read it, and I got another note from him, handwritten, saying, you know, he loved the book, and we should get together, we should have lunch, or we should have coffee, or something like that, which I was very happy to do, because I love the guy. I mean, I'm an unashamed Democrat and a big Clinton fan, and I thought he did a great job, and I was looking forward to go to have lunch with him and have a chat. But then we were in the middle of trying to arrange it. I was on tour last year, like you said, like forever.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got back and found a message from him, and I'd missed the date, obviously. So I then left him a message, and we were all set to go, except then 9/11 happened, which kind of threw him into total confusion. You know, he was very much out of touch at that point, because he couldn't be kind of appearing publicly and upstaging George Bush.
Right.
He had to be behind the scenes and doing what he could maybe to help unobtrusively. So any social engagements on his part were, you know, inappropriate, frankly, from that mm-hmm. point onwards. So we didn't actually get it together, but I hope that we will at some point.
And I asked you if you saved the recording, and you said no. It was
You see, I thought I was doing really well by buying one of these modern telephones that has no tape in it. You know,
uh-huh.
it records it digitally. And I thought, you know, you're a gadget freak, so I was thinking, you know, okay, I better get up to date. So it was on, there was no moving parts. So it wasn't like a tape I could take out and save. It was just in there somehow. I have no idea where.
If you would have just called me, we would have gotten it saved.
I didn't see how that would be possible.
We would run it on our show. This can be done, I promise. And if it happens again, you must call.
If it happens again, you'll be the first to hear about it.
Thank you.
I'll mail you the telephone.
Okay. I'll if you tell me that, I'll go buy the exact model, and I'll mail you the phone while you're mailing me the other one. And we'll get a copy of Clinton's phone call. And that brings me something that, you know, we discussed. We had two winners last night that were drawn out of a basket to go out to dinner with mm-hmm. us. Two very nice gentlemen, very intelligent readers.
Uh-huh.
We went out to dinner, and we were discussing 9/11. And you are from New York.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you're actually from Europe, but
right.
You have lived in New York since 98. And you were one of the people, you know, when everything happened. I know quite a few people from New York, but I know them in a more as work capacity. And when was it okay for me to send an email and say, is everything okay? I didn't want anybody thinking, oh gosh, you know, why won't these people just leave me alone? And we've got enough to think about. And so I waited, I believe, 5 days, and I got your email back reply immediately. Thank you very much. I also emailed Maggie. Maggie took a few days longer.
Well, Maggie's, you know, Maggie lives in Brooklyn, and her mm-hmm. all her phones and internet went through the World Trade Center area, so she was literally out of touch for a week.
Yeah. Her bookstore was actually
A bookstore is
close.
Yeah, it's not like adjacent, but it was close enough to be scary. Yeah.
Yeah. But obviously, and I could definitely tell from last night, and 9/11 has had such a huge impact on the whole world. But being in New York, and you still plan on, from our conversations, being a New Yorker.
Oh, sure. You know, the interesting thing, and interesting is really a terrible word to use in this context, but first of all, you know, actually we were tremendously touched and moved by your email and thousands of people like you. And in fact, you know, the book world as a whole is such a friendly, generous place that very, very quickly afterwards there was a website set up. Within, I think, a day, there was a website set up listing New York area authors who were safe, you know, because people were concerned. And we were moved and touched and, you know, really about the response from the whole of America to the plight of New York, which was quite a reversal, frankly, because when you live in New York, you realize actually the rest of America thinks you completely weird. You know, they think that New York is New York should probably be sawn off and floated out into the Atlantic. So it was a real moment of coming together for the country that I think New York was very genuinely moved by. But from my point of view, you know, the thing is, we are all many different people in one, as it were. You know, look at yourself. You are an individual person. You are a mother. You are a wife. You are a book lover. We're all half a dozen separate things. And for me, what was amazing to me was the fact that because I'm several different things rolled into one, I had several different reactions. I mean, like any other person, I was just upset and horrified by what had happened. But because I'm a European, I was not surprised, because we have lived with this stuff all our lives. I mean, not really on the scale of 9/11.
Right.
But in terms of waking up in the morning and finding that some outrage has happened is no longer surprising to a European person. So that was a slightly different reaction for me. My previous career was in live television, which included news. And so I had a kind of perspective as a news person, you know, what an awesome, awesome event that was, just in terms of an event. Then I'm also obviously a writer, and really two things struck me about that. One was that it really does once and for all prove that truth is way stranger than fiction, because I can guarantee you that if anybody, if I or anybody else had written a book like that 2 years ago, the editors would have just said, oh, this is ridiculous. This is not possible. You could not have four simultaneous hijackings with no weapons at all except little knives. It's ridiculous. Forget it. We're not publishing it. So it does constantly show you that actually when we make stuff up, we have to be quite careful to kind of pitch it lower than possible reality, because reality is too weird to be understood. And I guess the final thing is that I'm very aware as a writer, but also as a consumer of reading and movies and television and stuff like that, that we live our lives according to this kind of subconscious expectation of narrative. You know, we expect there to be a beginning, a middle, and an end. And we expect, generally speaking, it to be a happy ending. And what was very salutary about 9/11 was there really wasn't a happy ending. You know, the thing happened, and then according to, if it was a Hollywood movie or a TV movie or something, the outrage would have happened. I mean, we can certainly imagine that, and we've seen that in certain movies. You know, devastation happens, but then we fight back, the bad guys are caught, and there's some kind of happy ending. I mean, even to the point, I mean, and let me not trivialize this at all, but 9/11 happened, and then New York struggled to its feet, and then the World Series happened. And if it was a Hollywood movie or a TV movie, New York would have won the World Series. Do you see what I mean? It's a kind of arc that would have turned good in the end. Some little tiny consolation or compensation would have happened. But what is very salutary is that life is not like fiction. You know, it's random and it's chaotic. And so really the story there is still unfinished. We don't know what's going to happen yet. And possibly the whole thing will never be satisfactorily concluded.
I think we're seeing more and more of that in our current history of just from Vietnam to present, you know, of things not being concluded, because I think, and I mean this in a good way, that the world has become a smaller community and at the same time an awesomely huge community. And it cannot be patrolled 100% of the time, you know. Right. But
and it's a very complex community, so it can't be understood 100% of the time. I mean, you know, Vietnam is a really good example because we instinctively want to think of it as either good or bad. You know, we don't like any shades of gray. And, of course, the Vietnam involvement was bad. It was also good. The people involved in it, some of them were not worthy. Some of them were noble. It's a mess. And, you know, by mess, I mean a very complex situation with many, many nuances and many shades of gray. Mm-hmm. And that is how the world is.
Will 9/11 ever appear in any of your books? I don't mean just appear, but I mean, will it be referenced as a time in America before, after?
Yeah, I mean, it already is, because the book that I just finished now, which will be published next year, it mentions it in passing.
Okay.
Because I think that it's impossible not to. You know, it is a major watershed event.
Right.
And
I'm so glad you said that, because I agree.
Yeah.
You know?
It's something that I wouldn't want to sort of write directly about it, because, as you know, the Reacher books are not really that type of book. You know, they don't deal in terms of international politics and all that kind of stuff.
And we do have good endings in the Reacher books.
We do, yeah. I mean, the Reacher is fiction, and so it ends on a positive note. Mm-hmm. And but it's not possible to, you know, talk about violence or talk about fear or talk about bad results. You know, what happens in next year's book, for instance, is it's basically a story about gun running, and some very dangerous weapons are discovered. And, you know, they're clearly destined for terrorism. And it's not,
this is the new book.
Yeah, this is next year's book.
Oh, I'm sitting up straighter here. Okay.
Yeah, this is next year's book I'm talking about. It's called Persuader, and it'll be out about a year from now. It's a gun-running story, and a big cache of weapons is discovered that are clearly going to go to terrorists, because there's no other place this type of weapon could go to. So it's not possible to mention terrorists, for instance, and the potential result of a terrorist attack. You can't mention that now, except in reference to 9/11. And you're going to find that. People are going to say things like, it'll be worse than 9/11, or it'll be 9/11 all over again. Because it happened, and we can't pretend it didn't.
Mm-hmm.
It's like World War II happened, we can't pretend it didn't.
And it's like when World War II is mentioned in the United States, it was Pearl Harbor. I mean, that was our World War II.
Yeah.
You know, that's what took us over there. And, you know, we are going to run out of time. I wish I would do this for another hour, Lee. I have not covered everything I have to speak about.
I'll come back again next year, and we'll do it all again. How about that?
That sounds fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.